Good morning, everyone. It's about 4 in the morning on October 30th, and according to my schedule, this is the best time for me to respond to any of the questions that have come in during this month of October. As always, thank you to those people who have written in expressing appreciation for what it is we're offering on this website. And as always, I want to express my appreciation to Marcus Fellows for establishing this website and for posting these talks each month. I was planning to do this response on the evening of the 31st, but then remembered that that was Halloween, so the chances of my actually putting this together without a lot of screams of trick-or-treat, it just didn't seem like it would work out. So we'll get on with it now. I've had a lot of questions come in this month, so we'll get right to it. The first question that came in is rather a long one, and it gets a bit complex, so we'll just take this step by step. It reads, "Hi Daryl, I became acquainted with your books through Joan Tollefson's website and have enjoyed them very much for their clarity and simplicity. I have a long-winded question and a follow-up comment which I hope you can untangle and respond to. How is it that the mind, which is an apparent manifestation of this mysterious, unexplainable event called universe, has as its inherent tendency the inclination to explain what is inherently unexplainable? Put another way, how is it that the illusion of form has as an inherent tendency the manifestation of a mind which has the inclination to explain what is inherently unexplainable? Put yet another way, how can an illusion of form, the mind, arrive as your mind has to the conclusion or suggestion that what is being alluded to is itself an illusion of form? Can an illusion see an illusion and conclude it is an illusion? Is your illusion, which is the outcome of mind, any more valid than any other illusion, which is the outcome of mind? Or in the end, is it all simply a matter of which view each one resonates with? To quote Krishnamurti, is it possible for your mind or mine, which is the police chief and also the arsonist, assist us in finding the arsonist? Now a comment. It seems that the general inherent tendency, which we call universe, is to manifest the inclination to think and form the formless into descriptions and explanations. This then results in a formless universe, which via its tendency of mind seeks formation of itself through thinking, resulting in not one explanation, but multiple explanations. Yours, mine, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, scientific, atheist, and so on, and all seemingly logical from that frame of reference. To me, this then makes the universe a kind of Rorschach test, in which whatever the mind sees is true from that vantage point. With apologies to Krishnamurti, it seems as though the universe is an illusion not because its formless nature is misunderstood by the mind, but because its own tendency as a projective process leaves behind the arsonist's telltale fingerprints after he's left the scene. Conclusion? It doesn't make any difference whether it's an illusory universe manifesting an illusory mind in an effort to make itself seem real, or an illusory mind manifesting an illusory universe to make itself seem real. The police chief is the arsonist, and the arsonist is the police chief, and they both started the fire. So, I'm not sure if I understand this question totally, or the comments, but they all have to do with how I'm presenting this exploration of a non-dual perspective. So we'll just take it step by step. The first thing that I feel is important to consider in this question is just the fact that once we get into the world of thought and we keep our focus there, just notice how convoluted the whole thing gets, how incredibly complex and twisted. Once we start considering a particular view of existence, the questions then come about that view. There are all kinds of if, ands, or buts that are involved with any particular view. And if the focus remains on that view, tightly in the view, hoping that the view will resolve itself, it becomes incredibly convoluted and complex. But let's just take this question one step at a time. So let's start with the opening statement, or the opening question. How is it that the mind, which is an apparent manifestation of this mysterious, unexplainable event called universe, has as its inherent tendency the inclination to explain what is inherently unexplainable? Put another way, how is it that the illusion of form has as an inherent tendency the manifestation of mind, which has the inclination to explain what is inherently unexplainable? Put yet another way, how can an illusion of form, the mind, arrive, as your mind has, to the conclusion or suggestion that what is being alluded to is itself an illusion of form? So, just beginning with that question, like the very first line, how is it that the mind, which is an apparent manifestation of this mysterious, unexplainable event called universe, has as its inherent tendency the inclination to explain what is inherently unexplainable? The response to this is very simple from a non-dual perspective. The response is simply that there is no mind, and there are no inherent tendencies. So, once it's established that the mind is an apparent manifestation of a fundamentally mysterious, unexplainable event called the universe, at that point we can just leave thought behind, or maybe that's a sloppy way of presenting this. At that point, thought, perception and thought can no longer be the tool for explaining existence, and there is no other tool for explaining existence. The entire consideration within this non-dual perspective is really a consideration of what our actual experience of existence is. So, we have storylines. And if we enter those storylines, if we consider those storylines, we discover that perception and thought are telling us that there are forms. But if we really stay within those storylines, we also discover that perception and thought are telling us that absolutely every apparent thing or form is changing. So there's a major contradiction within our storylines. And if we really consider this, if we really explore it, we discover that fundamentally the sense that, or the feeling that everything is changing, every particular form is actually changing, that within the storylines has more weight. We all really have the impression that that changing is more fundamentally the fact than form. So even though we perceive forms, if we consider it within our storylines, the storylines that apparently arise through perception and thought, we discover that the storylines are eventually telling us that really these forms that we see are changing. Because ultimately all of us will eventually be saying in our lives that everything is changing. It doesn't matter whether it's the cells of our body, the appearance of our body, the moods of the moment, the thoughts in the moment, the urges in our of the moment, the actions of the moment, the urges and actions of our society, the weather, the planet itself, the galaxy, the solar system. All of these things have give the fundamental impression that they're moving and shifting, even though in a moment-to-moment situation we apparently see form. So in this consideration, we come to realize that thought has a major contradiction. And that major contradiction renders it useless as a tool for describing existence. Because if perception and thought is telling us that life both has form and doesn't have form, it denies itself. And more than that, within that realm of perception and thought, the sense that everything is changing somehow is fundamentally more the fact. We have the feeling that that is fundamentally more the fact. And it's not just my impression that that's the case. It's everyone's impression that that's the case. So it doesn't really matter whether we go to Hindu perspectives or Christian perspectives or Buddhist perspectives or whatever. Each and every apparent human being has this fundamental sense that all things are changing. And that eventually shows up in all of these teachings. So this is a general consensus. Now, I'm not sure why we don't examine that realm of thought, perception and thought, to any greater degree. But if we do, we discover that just this sense that all forms are changing, that's a major contradiction to our ideas that the world is made up of form or objects. And this major contradiction doesn't then leave us with the possibility of describing existence. What it does is render perception and thought useless as some kind of fundamental reality. It renders the descriptions of existence useless as some fundamental description of reality. So at that point, within a non-dual perspective, if that's realized, if we relate to this non-dual perspective, that there is simply the event of the moment and that cannot be described in any possible way, we're not left with a description. We're left with the happening of the moment. And we're left with no possible way of saying anything about it. So these complex and convoluted philosophical questions are no longer necessary, because we only ask a question based on the belief that there is an answer to that question. Once we realize that the world of perception and thought contradicts itself in a major way. It contradicts itself to the point of saying that it's useless. It invalidates itself as any true way of describing existence. Once that's realized, then we can no longer ask questions about existence in any kind of fundamental way. We can't ask the question, what is reality? What's really going on here? Because we don't have any tool for responding to that. We don't have any way of fundamentally describing existence. So again, in this opening line, how is it that the mind, which is an apparent manifestation of this mysterious, unexplainable event called the universe, has as its inherent tendency the inclination to explain what is inherently unexplainable? Well, if we really do acknowledge that the mind, is simply an apparent manifestation of a fundamentally mysterious, unexplainable event, then we don't have to ask any questions about the mind, because it's a total fantasy. There is no mind that has an inclination to explain what is inherently unexplainable. A non-dual perspective isn't fundamentally telling you that there's a mind that has that tendency. A non-dual perspective is basically saying that all of the descriptions of perception and thought are useless as far as describing a fundamental reality. They might be useful, apparently useful, as a tool for functioning in our daily life, but as an actual description of reality, they're useless because they have this major contradiction. Perception and thought tell us that there are forms, apparently. Apparently it's perception and thought telling us that there are forms, but then apparently perception and thought tells us that no forms can possibly exist because everything is changing. So at that point, the whole world of description becomes useless. It contradicts itself. It invalidates itself. It denies itself. And without the description, we're left with the happening of this moment, doing what it does. So from that perspective, I could dismiss the rest of this question and all of the comments. But let's just take them line by line. So the next question is, can an illusion see an illusion and conclude that it is an illusion? Absolutely, because if it's an illusion, it can tell us anything. Since the whole thing is an illusion and doesn't have to follow any kind of logical sense, certainly it can say that it's an illusion seeing an illusion and concluding that it's an illusion. Even the realization that it's an illusion is an illusion. And fundamentally, that's what a non-dual perspective is pointing out, that the world of thought has all of these contradictions, and fundamentally it's not going to leave us with some true description of existence. It's simply going to point out the contradictions, and in those contradictions we discover that thought, perception and thought, what we call perception and thought, invalidates itself. It becomes ridiculous in its questions. It becomes ridiculous in its considerations. The next question is your illusion, which is the outcome of mind, any more valid than any other illusion, which is the outcome of mind? Well, from this non-dual perspective, mind is an illusion as well. So this isn't a matter of an illusion which is the outcome of mind. It's never an illusion as the outcome of mind. It's simply saying all of these descriptions of existence are illusion. That doesn't leave us with a real mind having an illusion. And the whole notion of needing to validate my illusion as opposed to some other illusion becomes moot, because once the realization is there that thought invalidates itself, that the descriptions of existence invalidate themselves, there's nothing more to discuss. We're simply left with an event that can't be touched by thought. It can't be described by thought. The next question he has here is, or in the end, is it all simply a matter of which view each one resonates with? Well, we could say that in a way, but I mean, ultimately, within a non-dual perspective, even saying that isn't right. Because the notion that there are various people resonating with various views is ultimately an illusion. These also are simply descriptions of existence based on our supposed perception and thought. But again, perception and thought, if we really examine it, it invalidates itself. It denies that its descriptions are fundamentally true. And, I mean, if we want to stay within this question, this particular storyline, is my illusion, which is the outcome of mind, any more valid than any other illusion, which is the outcome of mind? Really, the illusion that I'm pointing to, the illusion that non-duality points to, is not just the illusion of one particular mind. It's an illusion that every mind has and every mind can acknowledge, because absolutely everyone eventually says that everything is changing. So it's every apparent mind that comes to the realization or comes to the fact of disillusion. It's every apparent mind that says all forms are ultimately changing. Now, if that's true, if every apparent mind comes to that conclusion that everything is changing, then what does that mean about our stories of form? We tell stories about form or things, and that gives us the impression that those forms or things are somehow stable and unchanging, and yet every apparent mind eventually acknowledges that all forms or all things are changing. It's a very simple acknowledgement that within this storyline of form, this storyline of thingness, there is this fundamental sense that all forms or all things are changing, and it's every apparent mind that has that impression at some point, if they apparently live life to any degree. So it's every apparent mind that has this contradiction to deal with. And I'm not telling you what to make of that contradiction. I'm just simply pointing out that that contradiction exists. So we tell a story about forms, and then at some point, the storyline itself starts telling us that all forms are changing, and therefore, form doesn't fundamentally exist. At that point, we're not left with the possibility of describing existence, because we can only describe form. What we're left with is a happening that can't be touched by thought, ultimately. So then he quotes Krishnamurti, and I don't know this quote, but I guess Krishnamurti asked, is it possible for your mind or mine, which is the police chief and also the arsonist, assist us in finding the arsonist? So basically, what I get from this is Krishnamurti is pointing out that there is a certain crime being committed here. This illusion is being committed. And he's asking, is it possible for your mind or mine, which is the police chief and also the arsonist, assist us in finding the arsonist? So basically, Krishnamurti, if I'm understanding this correctly, is saying that the mind is establishing itself as an authority, but it's also creating some kind of, or it's committing some kind of crime in establishing itself as this authority. So, is the mind a dependable tool for sorting all of this out? And from a non-dual perspective, no, it's not necessary. All that's necessary is that thought realize its contradiction. And when thought realizes its contradiction, it invalidates itself. So we're not left with a possibility of explaining anything. What we're left with is an event, a happening, a dynamic functioning, a vital occurrence, an ever-shifting flowing. And these descriptions are not an attempt to explain anything. It's simply pointing to a happening. Because even if all thought is dropped, even if there's no attempt to describe existence in this moment, there is the sense that something's happening. And none of us can deny that feeling that something's happening. There's no way of denying that with any fundamental sense that that would be true. All that gets denied is the possibility of describing this happening. Within these non-dual teachings, throughout apparent history, at this point, there's an effort to establish a different kind of vocabulary. Because once this contradiction is realized within perception and thought, we can no longer even use the word knowing, because it doesn't leave us knowing anything. The stories of a knower, a knowing, and everything known, these are invalidated. So within the Ashtavakra Gita, you have the statement that basically declares the knower, the knowing, and everything known, these do not exist. You are the reality in which they appear to exist. So they even dismiss the word knowing and they try to find a different word for this awakening to this contradiction. And so they use the word realization. Realization is not knowing anything. Realization is waking up to the fact that the world of thought has this major contradiction in it, and it denies itself, it invalidates itself. Now, within this world of non-dual, or within this non-dual perspective, even the realization is a fantasy. So again, we're not left with a possibility of describing existence in any true way. What's left is the apparent happening of the moment with a total inability to say anything about it. And it's not necessary to say anything fundamentally true about it, because the whole thing presents itself whether we're saying anything about it or not. And within this event, the apparent thoughts, the apparent descriptions continue to come and go. But they are no longer believed to be a fundamental truth. The thoughts and descriptions themselves are simply a totally mysterious event presenting itself. I won't go through the various lines within the commentary that he also included in this question, but I will leap ahead to the conclusion that he comes to. It doesn't make any difference whether it's an illusory universe manifesting an illusory mind or an illusory mind manifesting an illusory universe. The police chief is the arsonist, and the arsonist is the police chief, and they both started the fire. So in that, he basically seems to be coming to the same realization that many of the great teachers have come to in existence, that to describe it, to describe life in one way or the other, doesn't really matter, because it's simply one event. The police chief is the arsonist, and the arsonist is the police chief, and they both started the fire. So we can't come to a particular point of view that overrides all other points of view, because all the points of view are really the difficulty. And what we're left with is simply this apparent happening of the moment without any ability to really describe it in any fundamentally true way. So the next question reads, "Hi Daryl, if objects perceived in both waking and dreaming are illusory, then who or what perceives them? And what imagines or projects them? If there is no awareness, what is the support, the substratum of memory?" So once again, if we really do acknowledge that the objects perceived in both waking and dreaming are illusory, then we don't have to ask who or what perceives them, because to try to put together another object that perceives any of this is also an illusion. As he asks, if there is no awareness, what is the support, the substratum of memory? Well, there is no memory either. There's no awareness and there's no memory. Now, before we get too confused by keeping this emphasis on these questions and these comments, let's go back to some of the basics, just the very simple basics of our experience of life. So we have descriptions of existence. We have what we call our world of perception and thought, and they describe existence. They tell us that we see forms, and we describe those forms, and we usually live with the impression that those descriptions of life are the truth. However, every one of us has the sense that things are changing, everything is changing. So it doesn't matter whether it's the aging of our body, or the fleeting movement of our thoughts, or moods, or the sounds that come and go, or our visual sense of existence, it's always moving and changing because it seems like our head is moving. We're looking in different directions. We have the impression that the seasons are changing, that the planet is changing, that the solar system is changing. So all of us have this fundamental sense that all of the apparent things are, which seem to be stable, are fundamentally moving and shifting and changing in some way. So this is a major contradiction to our storylines about life, because on one hand, the storyline is there are things, but then the storyline is also that these things are fundamentally some kind of movement. And that sense that they are more fundamentally movement is stronger than the sense that they never change. So there's a major contradiction in our view of existence. That contradiction is simply perception and thought denying its own storyline. It's saying there appear to be forms, but there can't possibly really be forms. Now that doesn't leave us with anything to describe, because we would have to describe a form of some kind. Now somebody might say, well, we can describe movement, but then somebody else will say, well, how can there actually be movement? Because it's not going from one place to another, it's just always the absence of form. It can't really be change because there's no thing there that would change. There is only the movement. So, inevitably what happens is this whole realm of description becomes incredibly difficult and eventually becomes impossible. Added to this, we all have the sense that when we apparently came out of the womb, we had no description for any of this. And when we look at the descriptions that we've apparently come to, we can perhaps realize that the labels we've been given for all of these apparent things are simply sounds. The sounds themselves don't have meaning. The sounds gain a meaning by pointing to a certain apparent form, but then our sense of existence is that these forms don't fundamentally exist. So we end up with meaningless sounds pointing to forms that fundamentally don't exist. Now, this doesn't leave us with any possible storyline. It simply invalidates all storylines. It makes them untrustworthy as far as any kind of description of existence. And yet, even if we drop all the stories in this moment, there's still the fundamental feeling that something's happening. And it's happening all by itself, because if we sit here and do absolutely nothing, the whole event that we are, the whole process that we apparently are, and the whole process that existence apparently is, continues to happen. So from this non-dual perspective, or non-dual sensibility, there is simply this apparent happening, and no possible way of saying what it is. And yet it simply happens. So we end up with various traditions attempting to point to this event, not describe the event, but point to the event, and basically say we don't have to be concerned about ultimately trying to explain it. It can't be explained. There is only this happening or presence or event, this dynamic occurrence, this vital dance, this ever-shifting flow. So the various traditions describe it in their various ways. Some call it the Great Spirit. Some call it the river of life. Some call it the unformed ocean of existence. The world of science eventually calls it process. The Buddha eventually called it the unformed. He wanted to even get out of the ideas of form and formlessness and just say it is unformed. Or ultimately you would say it is unformed and unformless. He just wanted to get out of the world of description altogether and eventually declared descriptions don't apply. So either you relate to these considerations or you don't relate to these considerations. If you do relate to these considerations, then all questions about existence become impossible. because we have no way of ending up at some description of existence. And the only reason we would ask a question is that we believe, or let me rephrase this, the only reason we would ask a question as to what is the fundamental reality of life is that we believe we can describe a fundamental reality. And if we consider our common everyday experience of existence, the whole world of perception and thought makes itself invalid. It makes itself untrustworthy as a description of existence, a fundamental fundamentally true description of existence. And at that point, we're not left with any possibility of describing existence in any kind of fundamentally true way, so we're not really left with the possibility of asking any question about the fundamental reality of existence. So again, in this question that this person has offered, he asks, if objects perceived in both waking and dreaming are illusory, then who or what perceives them and what imagines or projects them? Now, if I was to then describe some other form that perceives them or imagines them or projects them, I'm once again back in the world of illusion, because if I'm saying, if we're considering that objects perceived in both waking and dreaming are illusory, then we have to acknowledge that the objects are illusory. The perceiving, which is another form, apparent form, is also illusory. The idea that something perceives them is also illusory. The idea that something imagines them or projects them is illusory. And in his second question here, if there is no awareness, what is the support or the substratum of memory? If there is no awareness, if awareness itself is just a meaningless word pointing to a form that has no fundamental form, it's also true of memory. Memory is just a meaningless sound pointing to a form that has no essential form. So once again, we don't come to the possibility of describing existence in any kind of fundamentally true way. What happens is thought negates itself. Again, all of this is just for your consideration. It's not telling anybody that this is the one way to look at existence. It's just considering our apparent experience of existence and looking at some of the difficulties of that. Since this is what is generally considered a non-dual perspective, I thought I would read something from the Ashtavakra Gita. The Ashtavakra Gita has got a number of different things in it, but towards the end of it, it enters this realm of thought denying itself. And basically saying that, in the sight of the seer, no describable thing exists. And then it starts to list the things that don't exist. There is neither heaven nor hell nor even liberation. There is neither degenerate behavior nor virtuous behavior. There isn't even any discrimination of truth. There is no sleep in sleep. There is no sleeping in a dream. There is no awakening in awakening. There are no thoughts when thinking, no senses when there are senses, no understanding in understanding, no sense of responsibility even when being responsible, not happy or unhappy, not detached or attached, not seeking liberation or liberated, not distracted in distraction, not poised in mental stillness, not stupid in stupidity. Using the truth, I have managed to extract the painful thorn of views. There are no religious obligations, sensuality, possessions, philosophy, duality, or even non-duality. There is no past, future, or present. There is no space or even eternity. There is no self or non-self, no good or evil, no thought or absence of thought. There is no dreaming or deep sleep, no waking, no state beyond them, and certainly no fear. There is nothing far away and nothing near, nothing within or without, nothing large and nothing small. There is no life or death, no worlds or things of this world, no distraction and no stillness of mind. There are no elements, no body, no faculties, no mind. There is no void and no despair. There are no scriptures, no self-knowledge, no mind free from an object, no satisfaction and no freedom from desire. There is no knowledge or ignorance, no me, no this, no mine, no bondage, no liberation, and no describable self-nature. There is no cause and effect, no liberation during life, and no fulfillment at death. There is no doer of actions, no reaper of consequences, no cessation of action, no arising of thought, no immediate object, and no results. There is no world, no seeker, no yogi, no seer, no one bound and no one liberated. There is no emanation or projection or return, no goal, no means, no seeker, and no achievement. There is no assessor, no standard, nothing to assess and no assessment. There is no distraction, no one-pointedness of mind, no lack of understanding, no stupidity, no joy, no sorrow. There is no conventional truth or absolute truth, no happiness and no suffering. There is no illusion, no samsara, no attachment, no detachment, no living organism and no God. There is no activity or inactivity, no liberation and no bondage. Without limitation, there is no initiation or scripture, no disciple or teacher, and no goal of human life. There is no being or non-being, no unity or dualism. What more is there to say? So these references are from a translation of the Ashtavakra Gita by a man named John Richards. And this translation is presented to the public domain, and you can find it online. So you just look up the Ashtavakra Gita, John Richards. This Gita or teaching begins by declaring we are awareness, that there is this realization, but as you move through it and you come to the end of it, it begins to deny all of these descriptions. And it's not saying that nothing exists. It's saying that these descriptions are not the truth. And what we're left with is just this vibrant, pulsing, moving, shifting, dancing event or happening, the vital occurrence of the moment, even if all the thoughts are dropped. There's the impression of a surging, pulsing happening, the happening of this moment. The sounding, silencing, lightening, darkening, pulsing, vibrating event of the moment. And that simply presents itself because it's always been presenting itself. So at that point, all of the, you know, if we relate to this perspective, if we relate to these considerations of existence, what remains is simply the happening of life, simply happening, and no possibility of getting into some convoluted philosophical discussion about it. Because it becomes obvious that these descriptions of form are not valid. The world of perception and thought eventually states all these things are changing. And even if we make no attempt to describe existence, We all still have the impression that something's happening here, all by itself. The whole process that we are is presenting itself. The whole process that existence is presenting itself. Just as happening, simply happening. Again, I'm not saying that you have to see existence in this way. This is a simple consideration of what all of us experience. It's a simple consideration of what all of us eventually say about life. And looking at the contradictions within that, either you relate to it or you don't relate to it. So a third question has come in. It reads, "Hi Daryl, I have quickly grown to love your brand of Advaita after listening to your talks on my iPod. Thanks so much for providing them. I live in a remote location in the Australian bush, and the internet is critical to my staying in touch with this kind of stuff. I used to live in London and would regularly attend meetings there, which was my idea of a fun day out. I am fairly well read on the subject and don't really have any questions, but I still love the many varied expressions of this. From my years of listening and reading, I have an observation which perhaps you could comment on. My observation is that there is often a confusion in the seeker as to content versus context when discussing non-duality. This seems to manifest in questions coming from two different angles. The first angle is, how can I make my life better? Versus the second angle, which is just basically the question, what is this? The first angle broadly represents a life improvement style of questioning, which varies from the mundane, how can I get more money, find a girlfriend, get a better job, etc., to the bigger and grander question, how can I find inner peace, be at one with the universe, know God, etc., etc. In summary, how can I solve my problems and get what I want? The second angle wants to know about this. What is this? How can I know this, see this, experience this? In summary, what is this ineffable nothing that is everything? I have presented this as a dichotomy, which I admit is a generalization. In my observation, teachers who go down the life improvement path will tend to attract bigger crowds and more followers, whereas teachers who go solely down the second path will struggle to fill the room. I think humans largely want to solve their problems and feel better, which I would call functionalism, rather than talk about the inner workings of the universe, which I would call structuralism. This functionalist-structuralist dichotomy played out in psychology many years ago, and eventually functionalism won at the end of the day, which speaks volumes about what humans really want. This functionalist versus structuralist issue is apparent in older teachings too, if we look at Nisargadatta versus Ramana. Nis didn't really seem to like the make my life better questions and would get quite cranky upon hearing them. Ramana would seemingly take time to answer them, although he might not give a straight answer. Nis didn't attract nearly as many followers, whereas Ramana had an ashram built for hundreds of seekers. I still see this dichotomy play out amongst more modern teachers, such as Robert Adams versus Eckhart Tolle, one of whom didn't offer any solutions to life's apparent problems, and the other who apparently is going to bring about world peace and teach you how to be in the now. Again, we see the bums on seat indicator of what most people want. Is this dichotomy apparent to you, and could you please comment on it? I have heard you patiently answer both styles of questions, but you always note there is never anything on offer for the seeker to do as they might hope. Sorry this was so long, but I enjoy typing. So, have I noticed this apparent dichotomy that is being pointed out in this comment? Yes, absolutely. You have apparent students that are interested in making their lives better. They want a teacher to tell them what to do. They want a teacher to tell them how to look at life, how to behave from moment to moment. And then you have other apparent students that are just basically wondering what existence is all about. Now, in the response, the apparent response to these kinds of questions, you have certain teachers who will tell you that you're supposed to look at life in a certain way. They will tell you that you're supposed to approach life using certain methods and certain techniques. And you have other teachers who will simply say, look, there is a totally inexplicable event happening here. You are an expression of the event. You don't influence the event in any way whatsoever. And therefore, there's no way of telling you what to do in life, because you ultimately cannot influence life. Actually, more than that, they'll point out that each and every apparent expression of existence is unique, and therefore it makes no sense to try to tell somebody what to be, because they will have a fundamental urge to express themselves in a unique way, and to try to force a particular approach to life on them won't work ultimately. They will have to be whatever nature expresses ultimately. So we have teachers that will go into endless detail about how you're supposed to look at life, how you're supposed to handle each and every situation in life, and they will offer you certain methods or techniques, certain practices for you to follow. And then you have other teachers that are saying, look, there's no explanation for any of this. It's all happening spontaneously. There never is anyone influencing existence in any way whatsoever. It's just happening. And you get a third group, we could call a third type of teacher, that mixes the teaching. So, you know, maybe 90% of their teaching is telling you what to do, how to handle each and every situation. And then 10% of their teaching is saying, look, it's all just a totally mysterious dance. It's just God being God. Or maybe it's 75%, 25%. So it's 75% telling you what to do, how to behave, how to approach life, giving you the impression that you ultimately can direct your life. And then 25% of the teaching is saying, no, that's a total fantasy. Or maybe it's 90% telling you that you're in charge, and then 10% saying, no, it's just God being God. You have this group of teachers that basically mix up the teaching. And yes, in this apparent display of existence, the apparent teachers that are telling people how to look at life, the apparent teachers that are giving the impression that you are ultimately in control of existence, and that there are, you know, there are certain techniques that will work for absolutely everybody, they do get many more followers than the ones that say, look, it's all just a totally inexplicable event doing what it does. Because people want control. In this apparent manifestation of existence, in this apparent manifestation called humankind, in general, an apparent human being wants control. Now, there's no problem with that. That's the expression of existence. However, when we're dealing with what is called or loosely termed a non-dual perspective, then we run into some contradictions. We run into some difficulties in relation to that perspective. Because a truly non-dual perspective cannot offer you the possibility of controlling existence. It cannot offer you the possibility of directing your life, because it's pointing to the fact that existence is a totally inexplicable event presenting itself, and that you're part of the presentation. You also are a totally inexplicable event that's simply happening. That is the non-dual perspective. You can't really combine that perspective with a perspective that's telling you that you're in charge of life, or that you can push your life in a certain direction. The very urges that you have to move in a certain direction, you don't create those. The very urges you have to approach life in a certain way, to apparently approach life in a certain way, you don't create those urges, nor do you create your abilities to follow those urges or to play out those urges. All of that is an expression of nature. We don't create our bodies, we don't create our brains, we don't create our needs, our interests, our concerns, our abilities, our lack of abilities. We all basically know that, because you can't just snap your fingers and have a different body and brain. You can't just eradicate all the basic needs that you have and decide you're going to have different needs. You can't throw away all the things that you love in life and decide that you're going to have a different set of loves. All of that's given. All of that's presented in this happening of existence. It all simply happens. And that's what moves us through life. That's what apparently moves us through life. So to say that we are influencing the movement of existence from a non-dual perspective is not true. And actually, I mean, from everyone's experience, it can't really be the truth. Because all of us will, if we're questioned, we will acknowledge that we didn't create ourselves. We didn't create our body, we didn't create our brain. And even if at some point in the future we seem to have the ability to manipulate our bodies and our brains, the urges to do that we don't create. All of that is the driving force of nature, or the driving force of existence, whatever you want to call it, this great, unformed, inexplicable event. It just presents itself in this way. And yes, it's true. In this apparent manifestation, so it's relatively true, or actually let me put it a different way totally, yes, apparent me has apparently observed this apparent manifestation, that more apparent people want control rather than understanding. And that's just the way existence manifests itself. There's nothing anyone can do about that. That's why with a non-dual perspective, nobody who's expressing a non-dual perspective, no one in that realm is saying that you have to look at life in this way. They're simply saying, here are these considerations. Either you relate to them or you don't relate to them. If you don't relate to them, that's fine. You will be expressed in a different way. And there's no problem with that. If you do relate to them, then you don't fundamentally end up with any explanation of existence. You don't end up fundamentally with any sense of a you controlling existence. It becomes apparent, or it becomes obvious, or the strongest sense is that there is simply an event presenting itself. No one is doing it, and it can't be explained in any way whatsoever. There were a lot of questions that came in this month, so I still have quite a few questions remaining, and because of that, I'm going to end this particular portion of this response now. It's rattled on a little over an hour, and it gets to be too much at a certain point to be listening to this kind of thing. So let's end this portion of this response, and if you want to continue, you can click on the second portion of the response right now. If not, take a break, go on about some other things, and you can come back to this, to the second portion at some other time.